I mean, it's a bit disjointed because I've got a Project Love Me, which is the new book, which I'll show you. It's the sort of main thing, but I've got 10 minutes I'll show you of a documentary film I've made as well, but we'll do that at the end. So straight after this, I'll talk to Aaron, and then you'll have a chance to ask questions, and you know, it'll just be quite an informal conversation, really. And then I'll show you the 10-minute sort of extract of the film, and again, after that, if you want to ask questions, that would be good as well. So basically, the project's called Love Me. I don't know how many of you even know what it is or what it's about, but it's, in essence, it's a look at the beauty industry, and it's a sort of human need to be loved. But it really looks at how the beauty industry have exploited this need and sold us this ideal and this sort of put some kind of level that we all have to aspire to. And how that's then been globalized. There's a sort of new form of globalization. This Western ideal has been packaged and sold all around the world. That really is, in essence, what I'll show you the pictures, and then it might make more sense. So I started off with some of the more sort of obvious, familiar things that we're the way it's almost used to seeing in sort of the West. This was in Iran. I'd heard that there was a sort of boom in nose jobs happening, particularly in Tehran. And I didn't quite believe it, but I went there and it was more sort of widespread and crazy than I could have imagined. This is in Brazil, where, and again, this sort of harks to this notion that sort of beauty has become a kind of new form of religion. This is a guy I met in America who was having a liposuction of his chest and abdomen and under his chin. And the sort of deeper I got into it, this was his quote: "I'm competing with men 20 years younger than me." And there's this kind of, I felt this kind of real desperation in people. This was in a breast implant factory. This is ironically one of the most difficult pictures to take. It took me a year to get agreement from anyone who makes breast implants to let me into their factory. This was in an under-16s disco in England. It was just bizarre because, you know, she was 14, but she was, you know, already sort of so sexualized, and, you know, Playboy bunnies have become sort of standard fashion item for under teenagers. And the boy was the same age, but still sort of so awkward. These are eyelash implants, or rather extensions. And what I've realized when I began the project, I think I was really focused on the kind of extremes, the sort of extreme forms of plastic surgery, and that seemed like the most interesting thing. And as I sort of got into the project, I really changed tack and realized that, you know, it's very important to include some of the more everyday things that we do as a way of sort of forcing people to realize that we're all kind of part of this phenomenon, really. This was Miss Atom in Russia. It's the nuclear industry in Russia votes every year. They vote out of all the female employees the most beautiful employee, which was just bizarre. And again, this was in Moscow, where even the Kremlin has become a sort of billboard for underwear. This is Christopher in New York. He just had a chest wax. And, you know, as I traveled, I mean, one of the other things is that I'd realized that in all my sort of travels around the world that, you know, we all sort of talk about this globalization and how places are looking more and more the same. You know, you can have Starbucks on every street corner and you can eat the same kind of food and wherever you go. But I'd also noticed that people were beginning to look more the same around the world as well. Christopher is, it was in a place called J Sisters Salon. This is a quote from Alain de Botton: "We refrain from questioning the status quo because we associate what is popular with what is right." And I mean, in the project, the quotes and the text is really important. It sort of underpins the message, and it sort of takes you on a journey through sort of different, quite contradictory thoughts sometimes. You know, one minute you think, oh, this is crazy, you know, look, the people are freaks, you know, what are they, you know, why are they doing that? And then suddenly, hopefully, you see yourself in one of the images and think, oh, no, this is on every level of society, and we've almost become brainwashed, I think, without, we don't even see it anymore. She's waiting for a bikini wax. This is Ox and Angela, they're in Rio. He was a plastic surgeon, this is his wife. And he'd performed 7 surgeries on her himself and was building an operating room in his attic, well, sort of on the top floor of his house. But she was kind of his Frankenstein's monster, really. This was in South Africa, Miss South Africa pageant. It was an incredible thing while I was there. They had all the former winners. They gathered them all there for this sort of anniversary. So all the previous winning queens of Miss South Africa. But they were all white until a certain period when apartheid ended. So there were these sort of 50 aging, white, sort of middle-aged and elderly women. And then a new breed of young black girls, you know, and you think, wow, this is the freedom they've won, the freedom to sort of be bombarded with the same sort of ridiculous judgment. And this is just from in a beauty show, a hair piece. She just had a vaginal tightening procedure. So still in the project, there were some of the more extreme things that people do. And again, this sort of benchmark is constantly being, you know, made higher. And it's almost like there's no part of the body that isn't targeted now. This woman I met in Dallas, she was in her 70s, but sort of at a glance, you know, she was quite a young woman. And then as you sort of slowly adjusted to her, you realised that she had bits that were old and bits that were young, and quite incredible. And also one of the unsettling things that I found in the project is, you know, what's right and what's wrong? And, you know, is it wrong if someone has a breast implant or if someone has a facelift? Naturally, our sort of gut instinct is, oh, that's terrible, you know, it's ridiculous, it's pathetic. And it is all of those things, but then the level, the line that we're personally willing to go to has changed, I think, over the years and the decades. And what did seem very extreme before is now seeming kind of quite normal, and people you know are doing more and more things on a personal level. This is a tummy tuck. And again, the procedures, the names of them are so marred, like tummy tuck. I'd like to lose a little bit of skin. So a tummy tuck is where they just basically slice the skin open and remove a section and then pull it together and sew it back together. This was an extreme one. She was a large woman. And this is in China. It's a leg lengthening operation. Each society seems to have its own sort of obsessions. In China, people wanted to be taller. In Iran, it was all about noses. In Brazil, it was about bums and breasts and actually pale skin and blonde hair. But all of these things tend to be kind of Western attributes. Here, what they do is they sever the bones in your leg completely and then build a steel contraption around your legs. And then you have to lie in hospital bed for 3 months. And each day you have to turn this sort of ratchet and it pulls your bones further apart. And while they're being pulled apart, they sort of try and grow back together. So you grow 3 inches of new bone. And after 4 months, you know, you get out of bed and if you're lucky, you can still walk. But you're taller. And this is the Miss Essex when she found out she hadn't won Miss England competition. This is the one picture I feel a little bit guilty about. and was very hard to take. He's a plastic surgeon offering his wares. And she's a aesthetician, which I don't know what that means. It's one of those made up words that people use for their jobs, which means they're not qualified, but they'll do some extreme things to you. And she had this sort of strange Michael Jackson look to her as well. This is in it's in northern Brazil. There's a football competition called the Peladão, and it's the biggest amateur football tournament in the world. There's about 80 different teams that compete, but each team has a beauty queen, like a mascot, and they all compete in a huge beauty contest. And if the team is doing badly, but the beauty queen's doing well, they can get reinstated and brought back in the competition. So one year there was a terrible team and they got thrown out, but they had a beautiful mascot. She won the beauty competition, so they were brought back into the finals and then they won it with a lucky goal. So it's this sort of weird mixture of fusion of body obsession and sport. This is a beauty competition in a prison. And this, unbelievably, is a fat camp in America. She was very proud of having lost 8 pounds. And this is the same beauty pageant in the prison.
Which country?
That one was in Brazil. And this is the sort of headquarters of a plastic surgery magazine. This is a guy with a hairy back. When I was in America, I realized that no one has hair anymore. I went to the beach and everyone's hairless. You know, in the 70s they had hair. I don't think we've genetically mutated and evolved in 20 years, but like men routinely shave their chest now. Even like, tough macho men in America. I felt quite guilty having a hairy chest when I was there. This is one of the Miss England teen contestants in her bedroom. This is backstage at the Miss Olympia bodybuilding competition in Las Vegas. And this is a surgery for women who want to wear little pointy Jimmy Choo shoes. And they basically remove a centimeter of bone from your toe, or three of your toes, and then bond them back together with splints. This is backstage at the Mr. Olympia bodybuilding competition. And these guys are in such a sort of physical state that their little lungs and their little pumping heart can't really sustain their body mass. So the people on the other side of the curtain see these kind of, but huge masters of the world, and they're doing their sort of, their routines, but every 5 minutes they lumber through the curtain and the medics surround them and pump them full of oxygen again. And then they go back out. These are sort of offcuts from a vaginal operation. To tighten and neaten the appearance. And I asked the girl, why did you do it? And she said, so I said, did you need it? And she said, well, I read about it in a magazine. This is a self-tanning, like a tanning booth. This is Dr. Pitangi in Rio. He's one of the best known plastic surgeons in Latin America, multi-millionaire. I mean, people really do know him in Latin America better than anybody else. I mean, better than politicians or footballers. He's absolutely famous. And once a month, he opens his doors up to the girls, the men and women from the favelas, and says, I'll do free surgery for one day a month because it's everybody's right to be beautiful. And so people sort of flood from the favelas and say, Dr. Pitangi, I'd like, new breasts. and he chooses, you know, a lucky person each time. In actual fact, this was the way it was sold, and they call him the Pope of plastic surgery. But the reality that I found is that all of these people around him are trainee surgeons. They're all paying him $50,000 a year to train under him for 3 years. And when they leave, they're all sort of set up for life, really, because, you know, they've all worked under Dr. Pitanghi. And so these people who come from the favelas are kind of guinea pigs, really, for everybody to practice on. This is in Sri Lanka. And she'd had about 16 different procedures. And she said to me, she said, "I may die, but I'll die with no wrinkles." And this is a quote. "One thing we do know for certain is that the body is the place where each of us lives and the place where each of us will die. Our body will always, in the end, betray us." And so there was this sort of sense of, you know, ultimate futility in all of it. And yet, you know, once you're wrapped into it, it's very difficult to step out of that culture. This is ironically in China, where people have nose implants. Instead of nose jobs to remove the bone, they actually add sort of pretend nose to make their nose a little bit more sort of Western in appearance and bigger. This was actually the winner of the beauty competition in that prison. Well, she was the previous year's winner, actually. She was sulking in her cell for some reason. This is in Senegal. Skin lightening is kind of all the rage there. I mean, you know, it's almost necessary that you lighten your skin with this bleaching agent. Or so the women tell me, you know, it's just become so standard a look. This is one of the former Miss South Africa's that I was telling you about, preparing to go on stage. And this is Jane's, I think of it as a portrait, really, of Jane Marie Powell. I use that instead of the picture of her, but that was her stomach that she didn't want. And this poem, when I edited the book, it was very difficult. I had a lot of pictures and I couldn't fit them all in, and things had changed as I'd been doing the project. The project I started didn't feel, after 2 years, it didn't feel like the one I wanted to continue. I needed to develop it. And in the end, this poem, oddly, was, I almost held up every image next to it. And if it didn't feel right or sort of resonate with the poem, then it would be out. And it was really, it sort of simplified it. This kind of underpins the whole project, really. I don't know if everyone can read it from where you are. But, and then there's a couple more images. This was a sort of before and after. It was sort of tragic to watch the beauty queens. As soon as, you know, you'd be standing around fiddling with the camera, and as soon as you sort of turn the camera on them, their whole body would change, and the face, and the mums would stand off to the sides and they'd say, "Pretty hands." And I kept hearing this, "Pretty hands, pretty hands." I was like, "What's pretty hands?" But it would be, to, you know, as they said "pretty hands," the girls would pull their arms in and then curl their hands up like that. And they'd been trained like little monkeys. And these were the English equivalent. And it was so much less polished in England. It was actually quite a relief, really. It was sort of, and she had this, I don't know if you can call that a smile, but it was more of a grimace. But she managed to keep it for hours during the day. It made my face ache. And then finally, these last two images. And then he was the winner of the Mr. Olympia. I think he's won sort of six times in a row. So yeah, that's basically, that's Love Me. Aaron, should we discuss it now? Should we go straight into a conversation about it? Hold on, I knew this. That's great. Yeah, should we sit here? Are you mic'd up?
I'm not mic'd up, so I'll hold
I've got
it.
A...
But yeah, no, I just wanted to start a bit broadly about this project and how it kind of sits in your, in kind of your practice, your overall photographic practice. Because you started off being a very kind of traditional documentary kind of photojournalist, is that right?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I mean, I didn't, yeah, what... When you look back on something, you think, oh, that's traditional. At the time, it didn't necessarily feel traditional.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's true. You know, it's a sort of more sort of reportage. You know, you feel like you're documenting life as it happens.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the difference. And then you realize, and I still admire that, you know, style or type of photography.
Yeah.
But I think after a while, you try and find ways of saying more.
Mm.
Rather than just reflecting something or capturing something that's there, I wanted to have more of a voice, I suppose.
Because in the essay that you write for the book, you kind of mentioned how you've kind of gone from photographing them to kind of to dealing with us.
Yeah.
That kind of transition, and you also set this body of work within your own life. You know, somebody who's in their late 30s, you know, going on 40. And these issues start to arise, and you start to realize your body is not, you know, invincible. So I was just curious how that kind of, you know, the personal journey, because you know, the subject matter itself is very, it's fascinating.
Mm.
But to determine that you're the photographer to do it and why it's important to you is another thing.
I suppose, even with Gun Nation, which was, you know, before this was the other book project I did, so that was a well-known project. But that got personal because I'd photographed lots of quite extreme situations around the world.
Mm.
But I always felt like an outsider, and it was always sort of us and them, and kind of felt worthy and important. But really, there was a sort of distance.
Yeah.
And then with Gun Nation, that was the first sort of change, I think. And that was more... Well, there was a series of instances. I mean, a friend of mine got shot, so that made it very much more real and stripped away the glamour of going to a war zone or something. And also, I was involved in the incident, so I went through an experience that was deeply scary and unpleasant. So you sort of think, oh, it's not a game. This is quite real. So I had an interest in doing a project that really stripped away all glamour from something, rather than kind of feeding this notion of, you know, this is what happens around the world. And I think without us realizing it, sometimes you kind of things can be a bit sexy or a bit dramatic, and you think that it's really helpful to the world, but actually it may not be. It might contribute to sort of racist stereotypes or just feeds this sort of drama that we all need. So there was a sort of feeling of like, I don't really want to do that anymore. And maybe some, traditional types of photojournalism does do that.
Mm.
So that was a personal thing of wanting to sort of back out of that a little bit.
Right.
And then Gun Nation came out of that. And it was also, I wanted to look at the bigger picture of things. So a lot of problems happen, but if you just say, oh, you know, people are running around with guns shooting each other, it doesn't actually help anyone or do anything. But if you look at the sort of political situation that allowed that situation to happen, then it gets interesting. And with Gun Nation, it was a look at the industry and the advertising industry and the armaments industry that fueled this kind of wild paranoia and ridiculous idea that buying guns was all about freedom and power and control, rather than just fear and paranoia and silliness. And so with Love Me, that was the same thing. It was like you sort of think, yeah, I am being affected by the media and advertising and magazines. And, you know, there's something about, I don't know if other people feel it, but sometimes you read magazines, they actually make you feel kind of hollow and unhappy and empty, and you know, you don't know why, and you just change the subject. But
I mean, think you said that with the work that you're showing. I mean, many of the examples, not that the book is entirely full of it, but the examples that you kind of presented are lots of the extremes. You
know, yeah.
On the extremes of beauty and what is beauty and kind of extreme, you know, plastic surgery and so on. But then, you know, you talk about how we're all culpable and we're all participating in this and we're all affected by this. And I was just wondering how you personally kind of look, rather than looking at the beauty queens or the Mr. Universe or whoever, is that, how do you see yourself in that, in terms of, how is it a mirror as opposed to kind of them?
Right. I mean, I've certainly felt the way, I mean, women have been sort of bombarded for decades with, you know, ridiculous stereotypes and sort of notions of the way people are supposed to behave and look and be measured. And I think that's a given, and we've heard about that, we've seen it, people feel it. And men, you know, I think the advertising industry and the sort of media have thought, all right, we need a new group, we need more people to sell stuff to. And so men have been targeted like never before. And sort of male role models have changed massively in the last 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And it, you know, things have changed. So I think there's a sort of awareness of that. And also, I think something else that underpins Love Me is the fact that it's not just about beauty or globalization, it's also about aging. Mm. And it's sort of, things are sold to us as if they're a disease to be cured. Because if you can sell someone a disease, then you can sell someone a cure. And so people are increasingly made to feel embarrassed by getting older, you know, because it's a sort of society that focuses on sort of youthfulness.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of runaway.
Yeah.
So that, I think I was noticing that and seeing that more and more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And wanted to try and capture that and felt part of it as well. A victim of it in a way. Yeah.
And often, I mean, photography is often held, as a medium, is held accountable for or responsible for or culpable, you know, in that process.
Mm.
Photography is, you know, one of the primary tools
that
drives this kind of industry, or it has been, you know, for the last 100 years.
Yeah.
And quite a bit of the kind of aesthetics that you borrow from are borrowing from that kind of world, you know, the fashion image, the kind of slick, glossy, you know, beautifully lit kind of scenarios. And then and within that mix, you kind of throw in some more kind of natural lit scenarios and so on. But I'm just curious if you could talk about that relationship between, you know, doing a project that's kind of confronting this notion of beauty with a medium that is associated with...
Feeds it in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other thing about... there's a sort of fine line between doing things that feed into it.
Mm.
You know, when I was... when I was editing the book and working out how to put it together and how it would look, at first I wanted to have sort of double page spreads and full bleeds, and you really play up the drama. And then I realized actually that it was actually just becoming part of the very thing that I wanted to critique. So it was then very important to frame it, reduce the size of the images, almost sort of have this more sort of anthropological look at what you were seeing, to force you to see it differently. Yeah, and I suppose using styles of photography, like there's still lives in it, which maybe using a sort of style that normally you'd see a kind of glossy little product shot in GQ magazine.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to play with the way you read images as well and not have them all the same. So you might see something quite hard and confrontational, but it will come after a series of quite gentle portraits, almost like family portraits or something. And then you see that, and so you don't get, it jars you out of that rhythm of, a lot of the problem with documentary photography.
Oh, God.
Does that mean no one's heard anything I've said up till now? I don't think I need to be that loud. Did someone turn it up on purpose?
Sorry.
Is that, I'm gonna move it away a bit. Felt like I came out of a dream then, you know. I've totally lost my track. But basically, I think I like to play with different styles and juxtapose them to stop you getting too comfortable reading it in a certain way. Mm. And a lot of typical documentary photography, the problem with it, in my opinion, is it's too familiar, and it has little symbols. You think, well, this is serious, this is meaningful. But you kind of just, it flows over you. Mm. And so one of the problems, if you want to deal with subjects that are real, mm. is finding ways to make someone even notice them or think about them or care about them.
Yeah.
So it's partly just playing with those things.
And when you're doing the portraiture, because quite a bit of the project is kind of based around that kind of the portrait. First of all, how do you get these people who are so used to and so aware of their kind of physical presence and mm. their visual appearance? How do you explain to them that you're not particularly interested in the facade? You're
right.
not interested in that. And then also, how do you actually get them to drop it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, is it just a split second that you happen to kind of grab, or?
It can be that. Often it is just a bit of a waiting game, mm. or sometimes I'm quite good at just giving the appearance that I really don't know what I'm doing. Mm. So they just get bored or frustrated, and, you know, sort of like some of the beauty queens, you know, they would stand, I'd set a situation up like a studio in a way, and then invite them in to be photographed, explain what I was doing, mm. without perhaps giving the full story, but I never mislead, I'd never lie, but I might just say it's a thing about the beauty industry and how big it is and how important and widespread.
Right.
And they'd be like, oh, that's good, you know. And so, and then often they'd come and stand in and then just these incredible displays.
Yeah.
You know, it would just be absurd. And you just think, and so sometimes you have to photograph people.
In the performance.
Just doing it.
Yeah.
And other times, not. You just kind of wait. And it's like watching a sort of plaster of Paris statuette dry and then start cracking and falling apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's different ways, and they're always different. Mm. You know, someone else might really be in control of their image. I'd never try and trick someone into looking foolish or getting them just pulling a face.
Yeah.
That ultimately, all you're doing is trying to get something that's it feels real in some way.
Mm.
But is there a secret trick? Well, I don't think, but it's just a matter of taking your time and...
But there's that relationship between, particularly in a portrait, between the kind of sitter and the photographer, where one person generally has more control of the situation than the other. And depending on the photographer and depending on the sitter, that relationship changes. And I would assume that quite a few of these people are so used to being photographed and so used to looking at themselves in a mirror as a two-dimensional image that they're quite powerful in that scenario, you know, and could be quite controlling, and I'm just wondering how you kind of approach that from your perspective as a photographer who wants to kind of get something.
Yeah. I always find the whole process, I don't think I'm a really good proper photographer, because I always find the process of photography slightly ridiculous,
mm.
and not, you know, people always talk about you're supposed to win the trust of your subject, and, you know, I don't think that happens very often.
Yeah.
It does occasionally.
Yeah.
But often people think they're trying to get something out of it. You're trying to do something with it and get something out of it.
Mm.
And if you're both lucky, it's the same thing. And if not, it's a sort of battle. And I try not to betray people too much. But there are certain images, and I think, I wonder what they think about that.
Mm.
You know, did I trick them or make them, you know? And some people have written to me, actually, and said, one of the mothers of the daughters said, oh, I've seen your book. Ooh, yes, quite a strange context, but she's still very excited to be in it. Can we have a copy? You know, and sort of, she wasn't, obviously didn't feel betrayed.
Is this the woman on the cover, or the girl on the cover?
Actually, no, it was one of the ones in their bedroom, the young beauty queens. I feel like I'm not answering your question. What was it again? It was sort of about...
It's that relationship.
The relationship.
The relationship that, you know, you're with somebody who's...
Yeah, it was about them being dominant, wasn't it?
Seems to revolve around...
It doesn't I don't think it happens like that. If anything, it's the other way around, and I feel guilty about that you've got more power.
Mm.
that makes me much more uncomfortable than someone coming in and calling the shots and being in control. That, because you can always just wait for that to run out of steam. You know, like the bodybuilders, they're all about performance and posing and everything. So they were very difficult to get them to look just normal. That was hard. And also because they're so huge as well. So you do feel a bit like, you know.
You'll never look normal.
But you just sort of stick with it a bit, really. And, you know, slowly they just kind of settle back down to earth.
How do you, I mean, it's a huge project. In the past, you've pursued big projects in terms of, but they've been very kind of located in geographic places, like Gun Nation being in the States or whatever.
I mean, yeah.
And I was wondering if you could talk about how this project developed. You were saying how first it started off with this the Iranian kind of story, and then it grew from there. But also, how do you, you conceive of an idea, I want to do a project about the beauty industry on an international scale. First of all, how do you convince yourself that you can do that? Because it's a hugely general topic and kind of covers the entire world. And secondly, how do you go about researching that? And thirdly, how do you kind of keep pursuing it knowing that you're not going to be able to, you've done incredibly well, but you can't cover everything. And how do you maintain that kind of sense of, this will get done?
Right. Well, there's like five difficult questions, but all of them are really interesting. and they're interesting because each time you do a project, when you start the next one, you can't really remember how you did it, or you get that overwhelming feeling of like, how is it going to be possible, and who's going to help, and who's going to pay for it, and all those sort of things. So, number one, you try and avoid the big question. You just start. And I discussed it. I had an agent at the time, and I pitched the idea to him, and he was like, "I don't really get it. I don't really like it." And that was hard as well, because I then thought, I'm all alone. Is it a really shit idea? You know? And I thought, but I've never really seen, it's so obvious, and it's all around us.
Yeah.
And it affects everyone. But I haven't really seen anything that deals with it. I thought, I'm sure it's interesting. But it wasn't one of those things that people around me said, oh, yeah, that's really good. It's a really good idea. Mm. Yeah, you should do that. So that was number one, sort of strange.
Yeah.
And then I thought, okay, well, I'll approach it. I'll do a couple of stories on the subject, and those can help fund the next story.
Right.
So I didn't think of it. I didn't think I'm going to go to 17 different countries, which I did. And how much is that going to cost? And I just thought, I'll do one, and if it works, then I'll do another one.
Mm.
So that's quite a good approach, just to, you know, get on with it. What was the other bit of the question? It was, it's sort of, and the funding is always an issue. You know, who's going to pay for it?
Yeah. I mean, did you, but what I'm, part of me is, I'm just wondering how naturally the project developed versus how kind of considered and,
I thought it'll all happen naturally.
Yeah.
I'll just do jobs and then I'll be in different places and then I'll focus on different projects while I'm there. It'll be a natural evolution. And it just totally wasn't. And I just sort of kidded myself for about 2 years that was going to happen. And time just passed.
Yeah.
And, you know, you do little things. And I realised that if you were in another place for another reason, if you were doing a job or anything like that, you never had enough time to do anything.
Yeah.
And so that was... took me a little while to realise that I had to prioritise it.
Mm.
And then also, and I think I was quite good with the research, I did start researching a lot, almost too much, actually, gathering kind of articles from magazines and newspapers and, highlighting them. And it was a sort of agonising research process, a lot of which didn't get used, but maybe it was a necessary... Maybe it was necessary to do it.
Yeah.
But they didn't, not everything I researched became a project, but some of them did. And sometimes you just have like a little snippet and you think, it was like Miss Atom in Russia.
Mm.
I just knew that would be a good image for the project. And it got harder as the project went on, actually, because at the beginning it was everything was fertile ground.
Yeah.
And then later on it was like, no, I just need something in Africa that talks about skin lightening. Mm-hmm. So it'd almost be going off on a mission to
So it was almost, but ideas started kind of evolving and kind of like being obvious. Like, well, I haven't covered this aspect of it,
yeah.
So I need to kind of go.
There did become a kind of hit list that I felt was important to cover certain topics.
Okay.
So the research was important, but then quite easy to get bogged down and buried under it as well.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need to go somewhere and things come out of the woodwork, you know.
Yeah. Okay, I'll ask one more question and then I'll kind of open it up to the audience. The look of the photographs, the kind of aesthetic, the way you've lit things and so on, it's very familiar from that kind of fashion advertising context for quite a few of the images, particularly the portraiture and the still life.
Mm.
And it's very clean and very kind of minimal. And I'm wondering, is there any retouching?
No. No, not really. I nearly retouched a light switch out of one of them, actually, the other day. And then I did it.
Yeah, it's a bit of a geeky question, but, you know.
But it's really interesting because, you know, I keep thinking, what have I retouched in my life? I've managed to hardly retouch anything. But when I say retouch, I have colour balanced and changed contrast and done things like that. But not...
You can take a spot off somebody's
forehead. No. You know, I really haven't done it. And I've managed to not do that, even doing portrait, even like celebrity portraits.
Yeah.
And what I've realised is that when I have been tempted to remove things, even simple things like, you know, a light switch on the wall, is that I do it, and then about 24 hours later, it's nagging at me. And then I look back at the picture and I think, I don't believe in it anymore. And it was almost like it needs the imperfection to make you, not just me, because I know I've done it, but I also think that there's certain images, once you remove the imperfections on a subliminal level, there's something like you don't trust it. And
maybe that's the same with the subject.
People say that about the same about humans. You know what? If you remove your imperfections, you're no longer human.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, that's all sort of part of the same deal, really. Okay. So the answer is I haven't retouched stuff. I'm trying to think if there is any exceptions. But no, nothing like that, no. And I now take a sort of almost glee in not doing it, even on, you know, like commercial jobs.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, a lot of pictures now, they're looking more and more like cartoons as well, aren't they? Like animated sort of images. But that's the other problem, is our eyes are being trained to see, that's magazines, that's what people look like.
Mm.
So increasingly when you look in the mirror, you're like, you look kind of weirder because you don't fit that, what you're used to seeing everywhere else.
Yeah.
And that's part of the same kind of package. So it's trying not to feed into that too much.
Cool.
But we could have questions if anyone's got any, you know, on any questions. A problem.
Yeah. I mean, before this is like a critique of everything in the magazine.
I've noticed, I have, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think definitely that has come into play with certain magazines because it is inherently critical of, you know, the media and the beauty industry. And a lot of the magazines are full of, you know, advertising from, you know, the beauty industry. I think there is a sort of a cautiousness from certain magazines. It has been published and it hasn't stopped it, but you never really know what's going on, you know, behind closed doors. But I've sort of detected that notion that it might be happening.
Off the back of that question, have you gotten any commercial commission, you know, commercial advertising jobs based on this body of work?
No, and actually what I've realised as well, because like photographers are always, I mean, everyone works differently, but my philosophy has always been to try and get work that will then pay for projects that I want to do. Some people would like spend months filling in grant applications. I've sort of dabbled in that recently and realised that I'd rather work to get the money because it's easier than filling in application forms for grants. But and you know, agents are always saying, oh, you know, you need new work for a portfolio, or you need to put stuff here, and oh, you've got a new project coming up. And I remember like looking through it and just thinking, this is not going to work with the advertising industry, because it's kind of quite confrontational in that way. Mm-hmm. So, no. But the more sort of cliched stuff goes down really well, I've noticed.
Beauty Queens and that?
No, I mean, other projects, sort of a bit more gung-ho and sort of... There's a sort of level that people like and they're comfortable with. And, you know, I did a thing on the French Foreign Legion once, and that commercially was always, like, really well-received. Mm. And I realised after a long time it's because it touches on sort of, you know, quite manly, edgy things, but it's not a war or anything like that or anything unpleasant. And it was quite filmic. Mm. So it ticked lots of boxes, but it wasn't confrontational or challenging to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, so... But this is a bit more disturbing.
Anybody else?
Yeah, there's always things, I think. I'm kind of happy I finished it. I wrapped up. It's very hard. I mean, you asked me this as well. Like, how do you sort of know when to finish it? And it was really difficult. And I think there came a point where I was never, ever going to finish it. There was always going to be another thing, and I was never... Certain things were quite hard to do as well, so... you'd always be waiting for this next thing to happen. And I really had to one day just think, all right, I'm going to give myself a deadline and it's going to end. And I was quite happy to finish it and sort of stop spending time with those people, you know, because it does affect you, you know, and you go and meet plastic surgeons in America and, you know, they say, oh, yeah, have you ever thought of having a nose job yourself? You know, stuff like that. And I just thought, I don't want to be in this world anymore. I want to be more innocent again, you know. Because you do, you tune into things too much and you start seeing it everywhere. Mm. So there are things that always, you know, that you'd like to have done or added, but I still feel like I'm happy with it to have drawn a line there. Yeah. Yeah. Quite weird not being able to see you.
I just thought it interesting that you said that text in your book is like one of the key kind of parts of it in terms of framing the viewer's passage through it. What do you think the message would have been like without the text?
Without it? I mean, I don't know. It would be similar but not as good. You know, it's a crime, isn't it, in the old traditional photography world to... Because a picture's worth 1,000 words, so why would anyone need text? But I've never really bought into that. And I love pictures and I love the way it works with text works with images. And then even that doesn't seem enough, and so that's why I ended up making a film. And certain things suit certain subjects. And there's not a lot of text in it. You know, if you add all of the captions and all of the quotes and the poem, it still probably only adds up to a couple of pages of text. But it sort of, they're just little stepping stones. Just one little quote can make you read an image completely differently. And I don't see any kind of problem with that. You know, in this sort of gallery world, you know, it's as soon as you have to have a caption, that it can't be art photography if it needs any kind of explanation. So that's the kind of game that people are forced into playing. Which is a shame. But, yeah, anyway, I like text. But they don't all have, you know, they don't all need captions, they don't all need explanation. And often the text doesn't explain the image, it adds something else or a thought or, you know, a poem that just takes your mind somewhere else. So they don't, you know, they're just sort of working their own way.
When you were editing the book, though, how conscious were you of that balance between... You know, is the text going to take over this image? Versus is it going to just simply add kind of a different tone or
Yeah, that was really hard. Yeah. You know, just the size and the density of the ink and everything, that really is a problem. Because, you know, if you get that wrong, yeah, and the early book had quite bold text, bigger images and bolder text, and it didn't really work. And you get quite sort of anal about it in Trainspotting and start sort of the percentage. Should it be 70% Pantone grey or not? You know, but it is really important that it doesn't leap out before the image.
Yeah.
And the captions are very tiny. So you have to kind of look for them, you know.
Yeah, so the image is kind of grab your attention first and then...
Yeah, so it is quite a kind of tight, right, balancing act. But yeah, if you get it right, it's good. And if you don't, it's ruined. So yeah, any other questions?
Yes, when you're researching, do you mainly do your research during the project? How much do you start when you decide it's time to start taking photographs?
Yeah, try and sort of just start, often, start gathering stuff without really knowing I'm going to even do anything with it, you know what I mean? Just sort of, you're tuning your mind into a subject. So there's no rule to it, but it's just nice to sort of have got your brain onto it and a bit of knowledge and get some ideas together and then start, and then something kind of sticks, you think, well, that could be good as a trip.
You mentioned you spoke to your agent in response to it, and so was you playing around with this idea for quite a while before you...
Yeah, because recently I looked back at, I had a kind of cuttings folder, and I was like appalled at how the first cutting was so long ago. And I was thinking, my God, it can't have been this long ago that I actually first had the idea. But, it was like a couple of years before I even took a picture. But I don't think I thought, oh, that's going to be a great project straight away. I think I just started sort of collecting interesting things. And then it sort of builds up and you think, all right, this could make a project. So, yeah, I guess to answer it, yeah, there is quite a period of build-up. But not always. I think just as easily you could read something and just inspire you to go off and do it. The hard thing is that moment of actually just doing it, isn't it? Sort of thinking it's going to work out. But I think, it's good to gather some information before.
Do you go into situations kind of looking for images or thinking, I've got to get this one? You know what I mean?
Because
when you do the research, you kind of see, you kind of imagine the perfect scenario and you imagine what the kind of environment's going to look like and what the people are going to look like.
Yeah.
I mean, how much... Do you try to block that out? Do you try to block out the kind of, and just see what you get? Or do you kind of go in there saying, I've got to get a shot of...
I think it's good to have almost like a thing that you're after. Because it strikes me that as soon as you've got an image of something you go for, other things always happen and you always see and find other things. But you almost need that driving thing to make you go there and be there. So, I don't sort of shy away from a preconceived idea of what it might be like. But it's almost like, get that and then get something much more interesting or better if you can. But, yeah, it doesn't feel wrong to have a clear idea of something. I mean, once I even drew a picture of something I wanted, Yeah, I mean, it kind of did happen. Like, 3 years later, I got a picture like it.
Is there a scenario like... where you've gone in and you've done this, where you kind of get the obvious shot,
yeah,
and then wait it out, and actually got something that surprised you, that kind of jumped out?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, yeah, if you have too set a notion of what you're after, you can just go and do it and then leave and then go home. And then really probably what you're going to end up with is loads of very cliched images. So that's the danger. But yeah, often it's just enough to get you to point
A. It seems like a lot of photographers kind of, they have to get that out of their system first.
Yeah.
But then they have to kind of...
Yeah, but why not?
Kind of push themselves beyond that limit of boredom and there's nothing left here for me to do. and kind of see what actually what happens past that line.
Yeah, no, it is true. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, you just stay an extra day somewhere and something brilliant happens. Yeah. And other times it just doesn't, and you think that was a complete waste of time. But you have to just probably put yourself there and you know, hope for the best. But yeah, a bit of planning, you know, and it's, I think that's not a problem.
Okay. Harry, how are we doing for time? Should we...
I think maybe we can show the film.
Yeah? Okay.
Like right, any so other questions before we...
Shall I go first? I wonder if you have an objective in your work, if you feel like you're trying to reveal something or you want to change something, or if you're just doing what you do.
Yeah, I think there's always an objective. Sometimes it's a sort of struggle to really identify a clear objective, but it's definitely a sort of, I mean, like when I did this project, I sort of imagined in my head that it would be a sort of project that might be sealed in a time capsule and bombed into space as an apology for future generations, you know, or aliens would get it and think, oh, this is what they did to themselves. You know, they had such a good start and, you know, this is where it ended. Or just historically, where you might look back on a period of time and you think, this is what we were doing, you know. So there's always a sort of historical thought to it and almost like a sort of a wake-up call to us, really, as a sort of, you know, because it's a way of sort of jolting yourself out of just sort of day-to-day sense of being brainwashed into something. And it was like with Gun Nation, you know, that was about a situation in America that had become normal. Everybody saw it as normal, but it was like, no, it's not normal, it's extraordinary. And so it was a way of trying to frame it that even someone who was living it and breathing it, who thought it was normal, would see it for the first time as extraordinary. So I guess that's the objective, really. And then what you do with that, I don't know. But yeah, that's it.
Should we show the film and then come back for more questions? Is that
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really difficult with the film because it's an hour-long film, and so I'm just going to show the first 10 minutes. It's on a completely different subject matter. I'll show you a few still images, but basically I went to Texas, and it was like a self-initiated project, which I pitched to a magazine just before the election when Bush came to power. Hopefully it's queued up. First little technical issue. Does it go... Might have to press play, I think, on the slideshow. I know this is the actual film. Can we put the stills on Simon? Can you put Lightroom on? Just I'll just show a number of images. Yeah, basically, so it was a story. You know, the American election was just about to happen, and it looked like George Bush was going to win. And I'd been traveling in America doing Gun Nation. And so my sort of focus was there. And I was reading all these articles about Bush and Texas. And as I read them, I thought, it can't really be, is it true? You know, and I found out that the petrochemical industry in Texas had been, they'd had a loophole in the law for 20 years, which said that if you release any amount of toxic substance into the atmosphere, as long as you call it an accident, which is called an upset in America, and you log it, then you're excused. There's no penalty. And also, the other things that are happening in Texas is it was like it had become the number one death penalty state in America. So more people were being executed per year. It was the worst for social spending. It just, every sort of box that you could tick of badness was ticked. And Bush had been a governor for two terms, and he was about to become president. So this story was Toxic Texas, and it was subtitled Bush's Backyard. And I traveled around Texas for 3 weeks. I just hired a car, and it was a sort of reverse holiday. It was like going to all the most miserable places. This is a place called Refinery Row. And what was happening is that people living on the fence line, in the fence line communities next to petrochemical plants, were taking the brunt of this law, this loophole that let industry pollute really without any kind of regulation. And people's, and this is a housing estate called Carver Terrace, and that was their playground, was just like living like in the shadow of these massively polluting industrial plants. And it was one of these stories that, you know, you do, and it really gets under your skin. And it got published, and, you know, by the time it's published, they sort of, I wrote something, but it got cut down, and the images, you know, they edit them, and it's never quite what you wanted it to be. And that was why, I suppose, I ended up making a film about it. This guy is called Mr. Williams. The film focused on him quite a lot. This is him and his home. He'd spent 10 years with these upsets and these kind of massive explosions that would happen in the night, and he'd have to sort of flee his home. And he fought a legal battle but lost. And this wasn't in the film. This was the Huntsville Death Chamber. I think this is actually the most depressing place I've ever been in my life, standing in that room. And these are the people who are executed, who are buried in sort of unmarked graves if their families don't collect them. Most of them are poor as well and sort of just left on the shelf, really. So let's play. I'll play the first 10 minutes of the film. It's frustrating because it's just sort of warming up and then it ends, you know. But then you can, if you've got any other questions, I'll talk to you about that then. The beginning of that, and then it goes into the whole community and gets more. And there's some great sort of interviews with the refinery bosses as well in there, which were very difficult to do. You know, like you feel a bit out of your depth, and I was also filming as well, so you end up with these quite sort of groomed professional spokesmen, heads of petrochemical industries, and you know their profits are in, they're not millions, they're billions of dollars a year, and so there's a lot at stake, and so it's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, filming. For me, watching that, the kind of one thing that the two projects share, the Love Me and this, is that notion that you're investigating what might be considered victims. I mean, this is an obvious kind of literal case of people who are victims of a situation, and the other being a more, you know, fuzzy version of victims of the beauty world, the fashion industry, or cultures that they exist in, and so on. I was just wondering, I mean, when you go into these projects, are you going into them ready to fight for a cause? What inspires you to kind of choose these particular projects? Are you, you know, did you find yourself being particularly interested in environmentalism, or was it a story that you felt like this is a story that needs to be told, or was it simply this would make a great project?
I think you're right about the, you know, the idea of being victims, and it, you know, and that includes me in it as well. You know, this. Hold on, I'm having a bit of technical issues. That does seem to underpin a lot of the more serious, important projects I've done. And I don't think it could have been about the death penalty. You know, that was just as shocking and disturbing to me. Because I stood outside the execution chamber when someone was executed. And it was one of the most chilling things to sort of be looking at your clock and, you know, watching the minutes tick away. And then at 6 o'clock, you know, someone's put to death, and then the family started screaming and crying and things. But I mean, it's complicated. You don't know what the person did, and you know, it's very complicated. So I could have easily have made something about that, but I suppose this was even bigger. It was it was just industry could, they could have solved this at the stroke of a pen on one afternoon. It was something that doesn't have to be that way. So there's always a notion that it's always a subject that could be a lot better,
yeah,
quite easily. That's what, you know, I find that appealing, rather than just something that's unavoidable. Mm. So that is an attractive thing. Why that in particular? I mean, I met this, unfortunately you didn't see him in that extract, but there was a guy, Mr. Williams, who was in the stills, and I'd photographed him and interviewed him. And his story really got to me. And I remembered him like 2 years later. And the characters that, you know, really mean something to you, you remember their names as well. Mm. And so I think he was the inspiration for the film in a way. Mm. And the idea that the film would be like him getting one back on the local industry was very appealing as well.
Yeah, I mean, and the obvious question, why move from photography to film? Why go from the stills to moving image? I mean, that we could talk about that for the next 3 hours.
Yeah.
But what provoked you to say this has to be a film? Because what's interesting, I found, quite a few of the shots were quite static.
Yeah. I'd like to apologise for the juddery nature of some of the moving shots. They're not like that. It's a DVD issue. It's
and
agonising.
And also, you use text quite similarly. In the book, you know, you kind of have these breaks of kind of text rather than it being spoken or rather than it kind of being introduced in another way. And I'm just wondering, you know, yeah. I mean, the question would be obviously why do you feel like you can jump from photography to film,
right,
and back again, and that sort of thing? And secondly, you know, what was that experience like?
Yeah. I think there's certain subjects, like I've just been doing something recently and someone said, oh, you can make a film. And I thought, no, it's actually much better for a stills project. Mm. So I don't think it's a natural thing to try, you know, film's always better. Mm. But there's certain things, there's only so much you can kind of pack into a magazine article or an exhibition even, or a book. Mm. I mean, obviously a book's a million times better than a magazine article, but in terms of what you can do and the control and things you can play with. But there are certain things, just the way people talk and how evocative music can be, or that you, they're just too attractive sometimes, you know. And so, and that story was so complex, it just needed a film to do it justice. Mm. So it just felt like, oh, it's still bugging me. I'm going to have to make a film.
Yeah.
You know, it was like I didn't even want to. I just thought I'm going to have to do it. Otherwise, it's going to be...
Yeah, but from a photographer's perspective, you know, photographers generally are quite a bit control freaky about the nature of things. And also, you know, with your book, you're talking about how you just pored over the editing.
Yeah.
And a film, you know, has lots of issues with collaboration and somebody's got to do the sound. And, you know, how much were you on top of all of that stuff? Were you sitting in the editing suite every day? Were you doing all the camera work?
Right. Pretty much.
Yeah.
First trip, I went twice. First time I took someone to help.
Yeah.
And he did a bit of camera work and I did most of it. He did some, then he did sound. And then the second time I did it on my own. But yeah, there are those control things. But, you know, the technology has evolved to such an extent that you can do it on your own.
Mm.
And in fact, nowadays, people who work in TV are forced to do it on their own.
Yeah.
You know, they're not even given the choice. You know, budgets are tight and that's the way it goes. So if you're a control freak, you can still be a control freak.
Mm.
And it also took me much too long to complete because of all these same things and wanting it to be this way and that way.
This one project came up and you thought this has to be a skills project. It can't be a film and vice versa. I mean, what? You know, it's a big step to take, kind of take on. I'm gonna decide this is going to be a moving.
Yeah.
It's going to be a moving image project. Having spent 15, 20, 20, you know, years of your life doing stills.
Sort of why? Do you mean why or how?
Why?
Why? It really is, I think, just you can just take something to another stage.
Yeah.
You know, you can, with Love Me, I don't feel like I need to make a film about that.
Yeah.
You know, you almost, it almost needs you to be removed a little bit and to just contemplate a collection of words or a single image.
Yeah.
And that suits it because it pulls you back and allows you to sort of to breathe around it. Whereas if as soon as you make a film about the subject, it's like washing over you and all these people doing crazy things, and it sort of it defeats itself. Not saying you couldn't do a good film about it, but
yeah, no. But I mean, from a kind of from a viewer's perspective, from an audience perspective, photography is quite an active. You know, it takes a bit of effort in terms of photography, forces the viewer to kind of build a, you know, really investigate kind of the picture and the text and how does that relate to the picture. Whereas a film can be quite passive in the sense that you kind of just sit there and let it wash.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing. You know, you can spoon feed people more in a film, in a way. So if you've got a subject that's maybe a bit trickier or less attractive or heavy, you know, you can, there's that sort of, you've got an hour or an hour, 2 hours of a captive audience to really sort of make a point. And people can be quite receptive for that short period of time. So you get, there's a very different way of reading it than if you go and see an exhibition or, you know, still images. Okay. So again, it's down to the subject and, you know, what you're trying to achieve, I guess. But I did feel with the Texas thing that being slightly, you know, having time and that sort of slight removal didn't help you care about what was going on there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It needed to be dragged right into your face and you needed to get to know the people.
Yeah.
You know, a portrait of Mr. Williams didn't make you feel the way I did about him, having spent a few afternoons talking to him.
Yeah.
Whereas at the end of the film, you feel like you really know him. So it really worked in that way. Well, I hope so. Anyway.
Right, well, I'm pretty conscious of the time.
Has anyone got any
out, so we should probably open it up. Yeah.
That's cool. It's a three-part question. So first, did the film benefit the community in any way? Did the bosses and the refinery see this film? So what was their reaction? And last, where can we see it? Where can we... I want to finish the film.
Right, those are all three strange questions to answer because, A, the film's really just finished.
Okay.
We showed it at a Sheffield Documentary Film Festival at the end of last year and then had a sort of private screening at the Curzon in Soho, and then there was a screening this week at Frontline Club, which is like a media thing. But it hasn't... We haven't got a slot for it on TV yet. So, and that's a sort of uphill battle getting it, you know, shown. You know, it cost a lot of money to do. It was massively time-consuming. We got won an award from Channel 4, like a £10,000. It's called BritDoc Fund. And that helped really edit it and finish it and, you know, it paid for the final trip. But it doesn't guarantee getting it on TV. So you've got this sort of agony of, you know, you've done it all and you want it to not just to be seen but actually to do some kind of good, you know, and... So there's that, and that's very much an ongoing process, and it's being pitched out, and, you know, you try and get film festivals interested in it, and TV people get interested if it does well at a film festival, and it's all kind of tied in. But it's just like photography. There's millions of people doing lots of really good stuff, and so, you know, you enter a new world with all the same problems, but the budgets are just higher.
Why is television your kind of target market, as opposed to, you know, like a cinema release?
Well, I suppose, I mean, just in terms of how much use a project can be, there's always that appeal of hitting a mass market, you know what I mean? And also, you know, I believe that, like, people like sort of corporate giants only self-regulate when the heat is on them. When it either becomes embarrassing or legally dangerous to continue. So I sort of hope it will feed into that.
Now, the only reason I ask is because within the States, the likelihood of getting an hour and a half television slot is a lot less, like, you know, I mean, not that getting a cinema release is any more likely, but do you know what I mean?
So yeah.
If it was something that was to go into the States, it seems like there would need to be some kind of...
Yeah, well, no, this one's cut to 48 minutes, which is like a TV hour, which allows for adverts and stuff. So you try and sort of tailor it to give it a chance. The Refinery people haven't seen it, as far as I know. Yeah, but we're genuinely scared of being sued. And so there's this awful dilemma of wanting to, like, send them copies and, you know, because we had to get legal advice, and I had to cut so much out of the film, and that was where it all got a bit dark and edgy, really, because, you know, you do it, and I literally learned how to use the camera. I bought a camera that I'd never used, just filmed people in the street learning how to use it, you know, went out there. It was all kind of quite sort of random in a way. But there comes a point where it suddenly gets a bit serious, you know, and that's when you're in an office and someone says, right, even to show this at a film festival, you need it signed off by a broadcast lawyer and you have to get this insurance policy which covers you as well, which costs, you know, thousands of pounds. But it partly because of the subject matter, and they sort of said, look, you know, one of these companies, they've all got like 20 lawyers at their disposal and they just put a lawsuit on you and tie you up for 10 years and they can bankrupt you individually. So you just, you know, so you just have to sell every possession you have to fight a case. And I was like, really? What? Surely there's a loophole. And they're like, no, that's what they do. That is what they do. And if they want to do it, even if they have no chance of winning, they will do that to you. And so you have to kind of, you have to edit it thinking I might end up in court at the end of it. And it's a really horrible feeling. But I, you know, my advice is to myself, don't make a film about the petrochemical industry in the richest state in America as your first film, you know, uncommissioned. That would be my advice to everybody in the room. Just do it as your second film, you know. But anyway, I've learned that the hard way. But, you know, once you start, you just can't stop, you know. So, yeah. Any other questions?
Can I just pick you up on something you said much earlier about style? And Love Me, obviously, you're playing with different types of styles that you don't expect to get the kind of shiny, shiny month of that in the jar. And it's kind of, it plays with that expectation of what people expect from a documentary essay. Whereas with the shots that you use at the beginning of this, it's obviously a story that's fairly horrific. And sort of black and white,
the still pictures. Yeah.
I mean, would you shoot something sort of which is kind of that horrific and shoot it as a serious project in black and white? Or would you, I mean, how does that compare to the kind of styles you're playing with?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the stills from the Texas thing were shot, you know, quite a long time ago. You know, I don't know, 9 years ago or something. So the way I might approach it could be very different now. But even at that time, I remember thinking, because I'd photographed a lot in Africa and sort of developing countries and had this sense of changing the world by photographing terrible things in black and white. And I remember thinking very clearly one day, all right, I'm not sure that actually I'm achieving what I thought I was, or I'm kidding myself. And so I thought, I might try and turn it around and photograph in developing countries in a more, in colour, in a more positive way and look for positive stories. But what I might do is photograph in countries that are much closer to home or Western, you know, in the style that I would normally shoot in, or, you know, traditionally you associate with sort of Africa horror stories. So I remember thinking, all right, well, everyone thinks of Texas as being this sort of, you know, cowboys and open vistas and, you know, the land of the free. But actually, it's a foul, polluted state where industry have gone mad, where people are being executed regularly, and people are living in shantytowns. So I'm going to photograph it as if it's a developing country in a kind of cliched way, in a way. So I quite enjoyed turning it around. And I think that's what I was thinking then. And then Gun Nation was in black and white. I had some of the pictures here, actually, but I don't think we've got time. But that the style changed a little bit then. I started using a larger format camera, and it was more sort of carefully observed, and but it still mixed in some documentary style photography with it. But it was, I suppose, a slight evolution from that. And that was partly because I wanted sort of normal middle-class Americans to see themselves in the pictures. Because in America, everyone thinks of, you know, the gun problem as being something to do with gangs and crime. But the reality is that, you know, 30,000 people are shot and killed every year there by guns. And a lot of them, half of them are suicides, and most of those are white middle-class males. And, you know, a third of them are teenagers at home. And the other half of that remaining portion are domestic arguments. So it doesn't really, it totally didn't fit this sort of notion that people had and the cliche. So I wanted to take pictures that made normal Americans see themselves in the pictures. So some of them needed to be almost shot like family portraits. You know, there's a picture of a couple, and they're sort of born-again Christians, and it looks like a little family shot, but she's clutching this gun in this sort of claw-like hand, and you don't even notice it at first. So that was a sort of a way of trying to tell a different story. But yeah, that at the time it felt right for that story. And I think it still kind of stands. I think I believe what I'm saying even now. Any other questions?
So yeah. Is there something about America that particularly fascinates you over, say, the UK?
No, I mean, there was a phase where I looked at a lot of things I'd done, and they, you know, a lot of them were from America. You know, with Love Me, it wasn't. There's 17 different countries there, and inevitably there's a portion of America in there because you could sort of almost say that's the sort of engine room of that, of this culture, of that industry. So it would be crazy not to show that as a starting point. But it very much wasn't a look at American sort of beauty industry. But prior to that, I'd had a phase, I suppose, doing Gun Nation as well, you know, because I'd spent a couple of years going there. You sort of get tuned into other stories, and so it had generated more as a sort of self-propelling thing. Yeah, and there is something innately fascinating about the place. You know, it's almost like a bit of a cliche in a way, that we get drawn to it as well. But there are lots of things that about us that they take and just exaggerate. And all this sort of, again, this notion that they do, they're sort of 10 years ahead of us. And that's certainly true in the sort of, in the beauty industry, I've noticed. You know, things that have become normalised there that seemed ridiculous and extreme and absurd to us 10 years ago are now happening on our high streets, and surgical procedures are quietly being done by people everywhere in Britain.
Can I flip that, though? I mean, when you turn up in this town in Texas, did they ever say, why, as an English, you know, the English guy turns up, you know, African-American, you know, poor community, can I make a movie about you guys? And what's their response? Were they like, why are you the only one that cares?
Yeah.
Or were they like, well, what's in it for you? I mean, what was their kind of response to that?
It ranges, actually, from just thinking you're crazy, like, why would you bother?
Yeah.
To, yeah, no, people didn't really say, yeah, I didn't get that in America. America's a strange place. People just sort of do it and get on with it and don't really question it. And sometimes I'm amazed, you know, you go up to someone and you introduce yourself and then you end up back in their home. And then you think, afterwards, you think, they didn't even ask me a question. Like, not even a question. And I cannot explain it.
Yeah.
Other countries, in more, you know, like in really bad extreme situations. Like, say, I went to Somalia in Africa, a really bad time there. I remember someone saying, oh, you know, you must be earning loads of money being here, you know. And I remember saying to them, no, actually, you know, if you knew how much I was earning, you'd probably laugh.
Mm.
And they're like, no, you know, and they actually just, instead of being impressed, they just thought I was an idiot afterwards when I explained the British media and, you know, that actually some people did stories because they thought they were important or that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And they just thought, all I would want to do would be to get away from here and you come here at your own choice. So they just thought it was a bit silly, really. But I am just amazed people just accept things, really, and let you get on with it. People don't seem to analyse it that much. Even with the Love Me, you'd sometimes, like the British beauty queens, so, you know, the under 16s, you know, you end up in one of their bedrooms, you think, why isn't their parents worried about, like, is this normal? You know, I met them at the beauty pageant and said, can I come to your house and take pictures? People just, I don't know what it is, it's just an amazing human. But, you know, I think the book's called Love Me, and it's something we all want people to be interested in us, I think, fundamentally. And I think that's one of the great things about being a photographer. Because you sort of sometimes think, well, how is that going to be possible? Or why are they going to let me do that? Or if I can't approach that person. So I'm always amazed that if it works out and that it does work out so easily.
Yeah.
And it seems to be because there's something innate in us humans that we want someone to.
But it's something about the mechanism of a camera as well, because if you just walked up to somebody on the street and said, can I come to you and hang out with you in your bedroom?
Yeah.
You know, whereas if you say, can I come and hang out with you in your bedroom with a camera, all of a sudden it's kind of like, sure, you know, that's normal.
Yeah, true. But it's absurd, isn't it? Because it's like saying, look, if you're interested in me, that's just weird.
Yeah.
But as long as you're going to broadcast it to the world, then that's okay.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, some people get pissed off if someone gossips about them, but then they do like their MySpace, and it's like, I'm allowed to tell everyone every little detail of my life.
Yeah.
So there's these sort of formulas that are okay. And luckily, the camera's been deemed one of those things, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know how. I mean, I'm always amazed.
Yeah.
I just think it's the craziest thing. I haven't figured it out.
Yeah. Well, Diane Arbus always called the camera a passport into other people's lives. And that's what it is, really. I mean, it's you show your passport and...
That really, I mean, it is. It really is that. And, you know, going into hospitals, photographing, you know, in Gun Nation, I spent a week in the ER room of a hospital, and I just absolutely enjoyed being there.
Yeah.
Wearing little surgical scrubs and a beeper, you know, it was my week as a doctor. But it just, you know, I was allowed to do it because I had a camera. And there were times where you just think, I'm standing in a hospital with a film, like this camera's been all over the world, and people don't even question it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but that's just one of those things, isn't it? That, you know.
Yeah, anything else?
So it's probably a good wrap-up moment, isn't it?
Yeah.